So, second part of Second Class Multiculturalism in Britain. Music is important, of course, because when you have music present in everybody's lives, that makes a difference to how we see a culture. But there were also more serious questions about, I don't know, perhaps politics is more serious than music, anyway. The present mayor of London, his parents were born in Pakistan. The present mayor of London is Sadiq Khan. And his parents were born in Pakistan, and he became a Labour councillor in 1994, and now he's the mayor of London. Now, of course, that's only one person, but I'm sure you understand that having somebody who is of Pakistani heritage as mayor of London is a very significant point, even if from a symbolic point of view. To get back just momentarily to the music, I mentioned Janoon as tremendously popular. There are also more radical groups like Asian Dub Foundation, who are, you know, more less mainstream, but very 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 loud political music, which has some some impact in Britain today. Asian Dub Foundation, but there's also very straightforward pop, and people like Raghav and Juggy D and Veronica, those are very, very popular pop music with some Asian inspiration. I think it's Raghav who has my favourite rhyme in modern pop music, and the line is, "You and me is ecstasy, tomorrow you'll be texting me." And that is it. That is really what pop music is all about. I love it. I love it. One more, then. Here's the latest Mela, today's Mela, 2018. Again, you can notice a few things about this. First of all, a free festival for all the family, inspired by South Asia. That's the slogan. And there's a whole number of things, if you're a historian, you can understand from that. First of all, it's a free festival. Of course, free festivals don't exist. Somebody's paying for it. So that means it's fun. It's coming from public money, and it's considered to be a public priority. You can see the different ideas there. It will be held in the part of London which is Southall, which is known to be the home of Bangra, the place that this particular music, this music mix from Asian and Western was born together. 18th and 19th of August, expect incredible international artists, magnificent musicians, and phenomenal local talent in London's biggest celebration of Asian culture and creativity. So this is a very very much a multicultural way of looking at the world, which can be criticised, and you can see it as positive or negative, that on the one hand, it means that you have more inclusion. On the other hand, I know there are a lot of young Asians who don't want to have Asian creativity, just creativity. Yeah, there can be a pressure to be in your own category when you don't necessarily want to. There has been some Asian British influence on cinema, and I think you all know some of the films by one of the best known Asian British cinema directors, and perhaps you've seen this film. Has anybody seen this film? Yeah, it goes on the television from time to time. It's a story about a young Indian woman who loves football. And her parents' idea of what a young woman should be does not include football. And here's the slogan said, "Who wants to cook aloo gabi?" It's a traditional Indian food, or Pakistani perhaps, "when you can bend a ball like Beckham." So her dream is to be like David Beckham, and not to be a good Indian, good Pakistani, I think, cook like her mother wants. So it's a very classic story. Yeah? In fact, it's exactly the same story as Billy Elliot. It's actually exactly the same film, but they just changed everything a long way. And I'm sure one of the reasons she got money for the film was that Billy Elliot was a great success. So pretty good film in general. And this is by then Gurinder Chadha. An Asian British woman director, very impressive woman, because I'm sure that when she began being the only woman and the only Asian. It must have been a bit difficult, really, which really was a very, very impressive woman. She also did this one, of course, Pride and Prejudice. She's now very, very popular. This was translated into French under the title Coup de Foudre à Bollywood. How many people have seen this? A few people, yes. It's losing bit by bit. Occasionally, did you like it? It's okay. It was a bit boring, was it? Okay. Fine. It was different. In literature, Hanif Qureshi, Asian British guy, who was very, very influential in novels, and in particular, this The Buddha of Suburbia, was a big hit. Sometimes Asian British novelists have to write about identity, which is okay if you want to write about identity, but you know, sometimes you feel obliged to. I knew an African woman who is an artist, a theatre artist in Paris. And I said, what's it like being a black artist in Paris? And she says, everybody wants you to tell stories about your grandmother in the African village, and I don't care about my grandmother in the African village. Yeah, there can be a certain sort of pressure to go into the stereotype. In cinema too, Ben Kingsley, very fine ancient British actor, and that is him playing Gandhi then. So just a couple of remarks about today. Moving on to today, here is then the webpage of BBC Asian Network, which is a radio station, a BBC radio station, so a public radio station, concentrating on Asian community, Asian music, that is to say India, Pakistani, Bangladesh. So here we are right in the heart of multiculturalism. That is that a public radio thinks that it's a good thing to do to have a specific radio station to bring these up. Now this has caused a lot of debates because very often black DJs or Asian DJs say, yeah, the Asian network radio studio is full of black and Indian people, but the mainstream, BBC One, BBC Two, they're all whites. Yeah, so yeah, there can be difficulties or controversies coming up with that. And so here we have the Asian Network Breakfast Show with Harps Kaur. Reviews, film reviews, and so on and so forth. So yeah, I mean, if you're interested, you can just go on the website, listen to the radio, and see what they do with it. There's also there's another one I put on the blog. Last couple of stories from 2018. There is a big hero in Britain at the moment who is of Pakistani heritage, and this is Moeen Ali. Because he's a great cricketer. Now, most French people don't care about cricket, but a lot of English people care about cricket. Not as many as the Sri Lankans, who are absolutely crazy about cricket. So there he is. He is the cricket star of the England team today. And this is the article about him. It isn't an easy time to be a British Muslim. Cricket helps. Okay, and this is giving a few examples recently of top politicians saying very negative things about Muslims and reflecting on whether having sports stars can help to fight prejudice. That was the story of Asian immigration, Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi immigration. So I have one more little story to tell, which is a short history of Caribbean immigration to Britain. Although we still very often in English say West Indian. Remember, this is the story that, you know, when Columbus was going east, he thought he'd arrived in India, and so it became called the West Indies, but he wasn't. Short story of Caribbean immigration to Britain. Now, the first Caribbean immigrants to Britain were slaves. There was not mass importation of slaves to Britain, but the British organised slavery for the British West Indies. Yeah, the British captured slaves and took them to Jamaica, Trinidad, and so on for the sugar plantation. You must remember, sugar was big money. Today, sugar is not expensive. At the time, sugar was big money. You made millions. The slave owners made millions from sugar. And of course, absolutely a horrible, horrible story of slavery. So I will move quickly on to the end of slavery because it's too depressing. But slavery had a couple of effects. So the black people in British colonies in the West Indies had an effect in that the anti-slavery movement was the first mass political movement in Britain, the first ever mass political movement in Britain, and this is the first logo. This is the first political logo in British history, and this is the symbol of the anti-slavery movement. And as you can see, it's a slave in chains. Am I not a man and a brother? Ne suis-je pas un homme? Et donc votre frère? So a sort of Christian side. Now, it's not Malcolm X, you know, but it was the first movement. And eventually, very slowly, the slave trade was abolished. The slave trade was abolished in 1800, at the very beginning of the 19th century. And slavery was abolished in the British Empire. You notice, slavery was abolished in the British Empire in 1833. Now, there have been 100 books written about this, but fundamentally, I think there were three reasons why slavery was abolished. Number one, the slave revolts. Very often, there were slave revolts in the plantations or in the ships. Now, they were often not successful, and of course, they were not very polite, because if you're on a slave ship going to Jamaica and you have a revolt, the only intelligent thing to do is to kill all of the white crew except one, who will take you where you're going. Yeah, it's not the right time to write a letter to your member of parliament. You know, so it's very, very violent, of course, and tremendous revolts in Jamaica, in Trinidad, in Barbados. So the first reason was the slave revolts. The second reason was the anti-slavery movement in Britain, which became a mass movement, and we will see, and this is a symbol of it. Very, very impressive movement. Sometime at the end of the 18th century, the 1780s, a group of 12 people met in a cafe in London, or in a bar in London, and said, oh, yeah, let's establish the Society for the Abolition of Slavery. And everybody thought they were just completely mad. You know, here was this slavery which was making millions of pounds every week, and there were 12 people. Well, let's abolish it then. You know, and yet they, you know, as they say, nothing can stop an idea whose time has come. So, second reason, the anti-slavery movement in Britain, and the third reason was economic changes. That is, it seemed to not be making so much money anymore, slavery, in that there are advantages, even for the bosses, there are advantages to wage labour over slavery. There are a few more reasons there, but if you're very interested, the book you want is by Robin Blackburn. Yeah, Robin Blackburn wrote the history book about the transatlantic slavery. Just a couple of the heroes of the movements. In Britain, when people talk about the anti-slavery movement, they always think of Wilberforce, who was a member of Parliament, who did play a role in abolishing slavery. But there were also a lot of people, and Equiano was one of the heroes. In some ways, he was a very lucky guy. Yeah, he was born a slave, and he managed to become free with the help of the church, and he went around Britain giving speeches against slavery. It was extremely impressive at the time. You know, he arrived in Manchester, and you know, people would say, you know, there's a black man giving a meeting. Oh, I've never seen a black man. I'll go and see. You know, it was really very, very impressive. And Equiano was one of the leaders. Yeah, of course, most of the leaders of the movement, of the anti-slavery movement in Britain, were white, but a few of them were black. And here he gets his blue plaque. This is just to show the place where he lived. Olaudo Equiano, the African, lived and published here in 1789 his autobiography on suffering the barbarity of slavery, which paved the way for its abolition. So after the abolition of slavery, there would be a small number of black people living in London, and Liverpool in particular. That is to say that sailors... there was not a lot of immigration, black immigration to Britain, because people didn't travel much, and it's a long, long way. Yeah? So you could mostly get sailors. In Liverpool, you would have quite a lot of black sailors who were working on the ships, especially after the abolition of slavery in America. They're working on the American ships, and then they say, oh, I'll stay in Liverpool a while, and then you know maybe live in Liverpool. And gradually, you got a slightly bigger community. In the 1930s, you got the first organisation in Britain, which was called the League of Coloured People. Now, in British English today, we don't say coloured people because, in fact, it's discriminatory because we're all coloured. Some of us are pink and some of us are brown. But at the time, this was the word people used, coloured people. We don't use this word today. And the League of Coloured People organised to help poorer members of the black community, just like the Jews had organized to help the Jews. And here they are, they're taking them on holiday because in the 1930s and the 1950s, of course, many, many poor children don't go on holiday, so they're taking them on holiday. There were also some terrible stories from the war. Because in the Second World War, perhaps you remember or perhaps you knew, they moved a million children out of the towns because of the bombing. And they literally said, you know, parents, bring your children to the railway station on Saturday and we'll take them away. Yeah? There was a lot of racism around. When they went to the villages, a lot of people would refuse to take in black children. And the League for Coloured People tried to fight against things like this. And here you have a public meeting, for example, meeting called by the League of Coloured People. This is in the 40s, I think, yes. Maybe 50s, early 50s. Come and hear all about Jamaica from well-informed Jamaicans. And they also have a political meeting with a singer as well. The outstanding tenor. One of the leading figures of the League of Coloured People was Una Morrison. She was a playwright. She wrote plays. She wrote theatre. And she was one of the leaders of the League of Coloured People. And I bought this book, but I haven't read it yet. This is her biography. This is the story of her life, the life of Una Morrison, yeah, who is not very famous, yeah, but she was a leader in that area, and she wrote, she wrote plays. The key moment for Caribbean immigration to Britain is considered to be 1948. And 1948, again, this is the situation where the law has been changed, and at this time the British need workers, and they actually send people to Jamaica. They send somebody from the London Bus Company to Jamaica saying, you know, do you want a job? Let's see, have an interview, etc. And so, okay, you've got the job. There's the boat for England. Yeah, so they came to England. And here they are arriving. Now, this wasn't really the first boat bringing immigrants from, I think it's Trinidad, from the West Indies. But this was the first famous one. And so the Windrush has been cut. And you can see a few things. First of all, notice the hats. First of all, they're very happy to arrive. Secondly, of course, the men have come on their own. They are hoping to get a job and then get their families to come afterwards. Yeah, this is some of the stories we were seeing last week in the television program. And there's the passenger list. Again, by the 1970s, you had something more of a political view of what it meant to be black in Britain. And when, in the United States, there was, first of all, the Civil Rights Movement and then the Black Power Movement, you got little bits of this happening in Britain, Black Power in Britain, by the Universal Coloured People's Association. That's a 1970 document. Going on to West Indian culture, I think I perhaps already mentioned to you that the carnival has always been tremendously important. This is a photograph I took from the Leeds Carnival. And they've obviously spent a lot of time preparing the costumes. Yeah, it's a very, very important moment of the year. In London, but also in Leeds, in Birmingham and so on, the carnival. And the carnival has a long history because, in fact, it came with the slaves from Africa as a tradition, and so it has aspects, of course, having a lot of fun, but also its aspects of linking yourself with tradition. Okay. and this is the Notting Hill Carnival. Gets bigger and bigger, and these days the Notting Hill Carnival, I'll see if I can put a, I wrote an article about the Notting Hill Carnival, I'll see if I can put it on my blog. These days the Notting Hill Carnival is first of all huge, and secondly very much advertised across the world. It was very slow. The Notting Hill Carnival began in the late 1950s, and in the 1970s the police were always trying to stop it, to stop the carnival. And there was quite often fighting with the police, among the police, between the police and young people. In the 1980s, you got more of the idea of multiculturalism, and so the police were no longer trying to stop it. And for a long time, every year, you would have a little film of a policeman dancing with an African, with a black woman, because that was like part of the Notting Hill Carnival. Today, it's very much mainstream. That is to say, for several months before the carnival, in most schools, they will be studying the carnival and have a dancer come in to explain carnival dance and carnival. Yeah, so it, this has become part of a multicultural way of looking at the world. Couple more well-known cultural people from the Caribbean community. Ronald Moody, Ronald Moody, then sculptor, Ronald Moody, British West Indian sculptor. There, I haven't got his dates there. In politics, C.L.R. James is probably the best known British West Indian. Doesn't look very political. His job was, he was a cricket commentator. Well, a professional cricket commentator. I'm told the best cricket commentator ever. And he wrote very political books about cricket. This is not so surprising, really, because cricket has, of course, cricket was invented by the English in India. And they didn't allow the Indians to play for a long time. So there's a whole political background to it. Whereas in Britain, you had two kinds of players. The gentlemen and the players. The players were professionals and they were looked down on because they were professionals just doing it for the money. So there's a lot of politics in it. And this is his book on. But he was also a Marxist revolutionary and the leader, one of the Marxist revolutionary leaders in the 60s and 70s, C.L.R. James. Okay, which leaves us with the final part, which I'm not going to do now because we're going to go and watch a bit more of the video. So I don't want to start it now, but the final part is going to be key dates in the history of multiculturalism and diversity in the UK from 48. And this is really history of racism and anti-racism. But for today then, for the rest of today, we're just going to look at the continuation of this Back in Time for Brixton video. And I just wanted to say two or three things about it, because it's a particular way of looking at history. First of all, it's saying that the history of black British people is just as important as anybody else's. But secondly, because they have this method of taking a modern black family and taking it back, taking them back, or pretending to take them back, it's a whole idea of the importance of feeling in touch with people from the past. So it seems to me a very original approach to history. If you buy a history book, you know, the history of black people in Britain, you'll find, and it's got some famous people and some laws which were passed, which is fine, you know, famous people are important, the laws are important, but this has a slightly different approach. I quite like it myself, but I